I'm Deirdre Boza, and you're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Happy Tuesday. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm John Fort with Carl Quintanilla and Deirdre Boza. Today, an interview with San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly, that Tech Check exclusive just moments away. And then we're live outside the courthouse as Elon Musk's second day of testimony begins. Tesla coming off a big day for the stock. And later, President Biden beefs up his cybersecurity staff. We will talk about the investment thesis for companies in the space.
We are obviously watching the banks, both Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, kicking off earnings season with very strong results. As well, as you can see, both stocks are currently in the red this morning. We're going to talk about methods in which the banks D are going to try to get more competitive.
Yeah, and despite both of them beating expectations, but the question is that where the real growth is? Fintech, as we often talk about, is becoming a bigger and bigger threat to the big banks, with public companies like Square and PayPal rivaling or beating in terms of market caps. JP Morgan is trying to stave off rivals by investing in the space with three acquisitions since December, including ESG platform OpenInvest just 2 weeks ago. CEO Jamie Dimon has pushed for more regulation for these companies. He also tried to share some optimism on today's earnings call, saying that while the competition is, quote, very large and very tough, it does not mean that JP Morgan won't win. And guys, you got to give Jamie Dimon credit for thinking about fintechs, which he has for a long time. A few years ago, he confessed to having Square envy. He said that they innovated where perhaps they should have. And earlier this year, he actually expanded the threat beyond fintechs, at least your typical fintechs, to big tech on an analyst call. He said that he told his employees to watch out for the likes of Amazon, Apple, and Google as threats that the banks need to keep their eye on.
Yeah. Amazon, of course, playing in dongles at one point. Apple teaming up with Goldman Sachs for that Apple credit card as well. But I can't help but think, Carl, that this environment is likely to shift. So many of these either challenger banks or, you know, consumer techs, depending on how you want to say it, they're in effect paying for customer acquisition, promising higher interest rates on savings, that kind of thing, maybe even sort of gamifying trading of various popular assets. That's probably not going to continue forever. And eventually there might be this flight to more safety. How do they spend their marketing dollars? How do they promote their product in such a way that consumers feel like it's a better experience long term?
Yeah, well, certainly directionally, guys, the banks have tried to evolve their business models. Goldman certainly moved toward the consumer. Morgan Stanley made some large scale M&A last year, trying to also be more consumer centric, D. But we are still awaiting that moment where they make some explosive purchase of a pure tech company to try to move into that space. And certainly Dimon, I think probably most of the big banks, has hinted that that's the direction at least they want to go.
Yeah, a few years ago, you got to note that Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon said that if Marcus were a Silicon Valley startup, people would be throwing money at them. But as John just mentioned, there's been a lot of competition that has come into the marketplace since then. Those savings rates aren't as attractive as they perhaps looked a few years ago. But joining us for more on digital banking and fintech is the production board founder and CEO David Friedberg. David has invested in SoFi and Dave, among other fintech firms. David, thanks for being with us this morning. I think you were just listening to our conversation, and you are on the fintech side of this. You think that they will ultimately win out against the big banks?
I mean, I think it's a classic innovator's dilemma in the marketplace. Fintech companies generally have a lower operating expense per customer, so they can make less profit per customer and build a great business. They also have this issue where they're not going to have shareholders lambaste them for a decline in profit or revenue over a short period of time, a couple of quarters. And so they can make the investment to take a more aggressive approach, make less money per customer per year, and gain scale very quickly. And as we all know, this becomes a scale game. And so I think that there's this inherent kind of innovator's dilemma problem that old school financial services firms face. Obviously, if they try and buy something, they step into M&A, they end up facing this issue where they either leave the company alone and let them kind of grow on their own. And if they do that, they lose the leverage of over their existing customer base, which is to cross-sell digital services in. And if they try and do that, then they step in and they try and run a tech company and the whole thing gets ruined and falls apart, as we've seen in M&A over and over again in many different industries. So it is this kind of classic innovator dilemma moment that we're seeing in financial services as the fintech companies kind of storm the field.
David, what about the question of regulation? Yes, it comes down to scale. And I know this is a very different market, but take a look at what happened to Ant Group, biggest fintech company in the world, about to go public. Regulators got worried about the business model and businesses that they had branched into, talking about credit. Is there a scenario where you think that U.S. regulators could take aim at American fintechs? And remember, too, we were just talking, Jamie Dimon has actually called for more regulation.
You know, it's interesting. I feel like the Robin Hood fine, the FINRA fine of $70 million was a good red herring for what's going to happen in this industry, which is that the big financial services firms want to participate in this market and they don't want regulators coming in and re-regulating the market. They see the opportunity in the same way that the startups do. And FINRA is a self-regulatory organization. And, you know, putting that $70 million fine on Robinhood was a big enough fine to say, you know what, we don't want the SEC coming in. We don't want big regulators coming in and telling us how to run digital businesses in financial services. We've got this figured out. We're going to regulate our way there. And so the financial services firms, as you've heard Jamie Dimon speak and others about the opportunity, they want to see this market evolve and they want to compete. I just think, you know, the regulators are going to be kind of pushed off for a while as they try and, you know, kind of chart the field and chart the course a little bit.
David, let me challenge you a bit on that innovator's dilemma thesis. It seems to wear off after a while in tech. I mean, look at Walmart in e-commerce, Microsoft in cloud, Disney now in media. After a while, it seems like smart incumbents do manage to react more quickly. And so why, in the case of the banks, are they not in position with the huge customer bases that they already have? They don't have to pay to acquire them in quite the same way. Why are they not in a better position to react more quickly than some others have in previous waves of innovation?
Yeah, you know, I think that you can pick the counterexamples, but the general trend in the industry is that the retailers have fallen apart and they haven't been able to compete effectively. Everyone from Sears to Macy's to Nordstrom, they had huge digital efforts. They spent an incredible amount of money trying to build digital teams. They all did big acquisitions. And while there have been a few ultra-scaled organizations that have been able to kind of get across the line a little bit, you know, I'll ask you the question, when was the last time you used Wells Fargo's website? And if you compare using Wells Fargo's website to using the Robinhood app or the SoFi app, it's a dramatically different consumer experience, and the fees and the interest that you can earn and the trading fees are all dramatically different still. And so while there may be some exceptions.
I do use Bank of America and Fidelity all the time as well as Affirm. And it's kind of a mix for me. So I get your point, but also, yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like the structural differences are there generally in the industry, and everyone's going to struggle to compete. But, you know, when you come into this market and you can actually offer a product that makes less money per customer per year because of your structural advantage, it's going to be hard for a big guy to say, you know what, let's slash our fees over this short period of time to try and get there without getting beat up by your shareholders. I mean, you know, retail banks in the United States rely on $30 billion a year in overdraft revenue. It's an insane number. And so, you know, if you can come in and offer a 1% interest instead of a 0.1% interest, and offer a no overdraft checking account, you're already advantaged against those big guys. And you start to get to the point that we were at in the late 90s, early 2000s, when everyone was kind of saying, you know what, I don't want to enter my credit card information into a website to buy something. And then guess what? Everyone got comfortable with it. And then everyone uses credit cards and they're happy to put it on any website to buy whatever they're trying to buy. We're kind of in that moment right now in financial services, digital financial services, where, you know, it was originally kind of the millennials and Gen Y and Gen X, and now boomers are saying, you know, maybe I should have a digital banking account and I should start to go online and I don't need to go into a store. And guess what? COVID reinforced that. And so we're starting to see that shift happen where, you know, the lower price, better digital product is going to start to win out. And you're going to see this shift happen over the next couple of quarters over to these digital first offerings.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder, David, you know, we can talk a lot about what the legacy banks would like to buy in that space. We can talk about what the regulators would allow them to buy. But I wonder, I mean, generalizing, obviously, but in the fintech space, who wants to sell? Who wants to sell to these guys? Who wants to be owned? Who wants to cash out? Or do they really believe that those tailwinds you just illustrated are so strong that they don't need to?
You know, I think one of the unifying visions I've heard from the CEOs and the entrepreneurs in financial services, and I've been in digital fintech, I guess people call it, since 2006. So, you know, I've met a lot of these folks over the years and we've spent a lot of time together. I think everyone has the same vision, similar vision, which is one-stop financial services. You get your banking, you get your insurance, you get your credit, and you get your trading all in one place. And you're already seeing Affirm start to do this. You're seeing SoFi start to do this. You're seeing Square do this. And so this move is to have one digital service that you can go to as a consumer, get all of your financial services needs met at a lower cost with a better quality of service. Everything's in one place. I don't need to go to different people to buy different things. And I think that is where everyone wants to take this. So they're all on the offensive. They're not just trying to build a business and make money and then sell the business. I think everyone's got this vision that is an inevitable vision, which is consumers should have one place they go to get all their financial services needs met. And it's a great experience and it's a lower cost than going through the traditional routes. So I don't know if I would say, hey, everyone's looking to sell and cash out in this market. I think that there's a bigger game to play and it's going to transform the financial services industry as a whole.
Right. You got to wonder if at some point there's consolidation because you have more and more fintechs trying to do everything. Discussion for next time. David, thank you so much for being with us this morning. David Friedberg.
Thanks, guys.
And we're looking at the NASDAQ hitting another intraday record high while San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly is next here on Tech Check. Stay with us.
Let's get a gut check on Airbnb. Haskett, double upgrade today, arguing that digital engagement trends have, quote, materially improved. It's the summer travel season after all. It says valuations here to stay. Lengthening stays, they argue, suggests there's ample Q2 top line upside, although shares, as you can see, down about 1.5%, John.
Yeah, and now let's get to San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly with our Steve Leisman in a CNBC exclusive. Steve.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I am joined by San Francisco Fed President Mary Daly. Right after this inflation report came out, President Daly, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
Yeah, let's get right to the hot inflation numbers, 5.4% on the top line and 4.5% on the core numbers. How do you react to this? Do you feel more or less secure now that but your outlook that inflation is temporary?
Sure. Though this has really been expected. We expected a pop in inflation like this, and it will come. It will be for the next couple of months. And the reason is there are a variety of reasons. We've all cited them. We had low prices during the depth of the pandemic. Prices are recovering in airlines and other travel services. Once those have done, we don't expect those to keep growing. We also have bottlenecks. Demand came back faster than supply, and there are these temporary bottlenecks. So right now, it's really remain steady in the boat. Don't read too much signal out of any month of data, and let's get through this volatile period so we can really see where the economy is.
Mary, when you look at the data here, anything specifically that really helps support your view here? When you look at, for example, used car prices up 10%, a third month in a row of really strong gains, food prices up very strongly. Do you see more temporary in this, or do you start to have some concerns that maybe there's a more permanent nature to this?
No, I really do see this as temporary, the used car being a great example. The used car prices are simply a reflection of the temporary bottlenecks we see in the new car supply because of the semiconductor chips that need to be put into the cars. And also people are going back to work and they need to get cars. And there are lots of reasons why we didn't have a good supply of used cars because of the pandemic. So all of these things work themselves out. And I think the main thing to recognize is several months of this doesn't mean that it's not transitory. Transitory is really about what factors are driving it and do we expect it to continue to grow going forward. And I just don't see that happening in the used car market or the airline prices or travel and tourism more generally, all of which are really driving up the inflation numbers.
But the real determinant of whether or not it's transitory is whether or not it embeds itself in the psychology of consumers. We just had the New York Fed report that inflation expectations hit a record of 4.8% in the next year. Do you start to get concerned that there is an embedding of inflationary expectations in the part of American consumers?
So that's a terrific point. And absolutely, we focus on inflation expectations. But here, it's really important to separate out near-term inflation expectations from longer-run inflation expectations. And when you look at the consumers or the businesses, the survey of professional forecasters, you see this pop in short-run inflation expectations. They're very reactive to the data. Once the prices stabilize and we don't have those high readings on inflation, they historically just come right back down. Importantly, long-run inflation expectations haven't made that move at all. They're really very steady. So that's what I'm looking at is how are consumers, businesses smoothing through what they see today and thinking about what's going to happen 5 years from now. And there you just don't see a lot of movement in this long run inflation expectations, which, as you referenced, is what we really depend on to maintain inflation expectations at our 2% target more generally.
President Deli, when you last joined us, you said that policy was in a good place. Do you still feel that way? And does that mean that you're thinking about a tapering, for example, announcement in the fall and reducing those asset purchases sometime this year or next year? Could you give us an idea of your timeline?
Sure, Steve, of course. So I do think policy's in a great place right now. And the reason I think it's in a good place is because it's ready to respond to whatever the economy brings us, right? We have accommodation in the system that is supporting the recovery of the economy. I'm very bullish about the fall. You know, I know there are risks out there with the new Delta variant, et cetera, but I'm really confident that we are going to have a strong fall, like we've had the momentum already expressing itself. With that, it is appropriate to start talking about tapering asset purchases, taking some of the accommodation that we've provided to the economy down. We'll still be in a very accommodative position with a low funds rate, but we don't need all the tools as we see the economy get its own footing. So absolutely time to start doing that, having those conversations. My own view is we'll probably be in a good position to taper at the end of this year or early next.
And what about raising interest rates? The market, after the last meeting, and the press conference by Chairman Powell pulled forward the time of the first rate hike into, I guess, the fall of October, fall of 2022. Is that where your thinking is, or do you think it might be longer than that?
Well, I think it's really premature to talk about rate increases. Right now, we want to do the following. We need to get through the fall, right? The Delta variant being so contagious and spreading throughout the globe and actually spreading in the U.S., that's a risk. We also have, we need to open the economy fully and have kids go back to school, see how many people we can bring back off the sidelines into the labor market, see how close we can get to our full employment mandate before we start talking about rate increases. So right now I'm focused completely on the timing, pace, and composition of asset purchases, and we'll do those first, and then we'll think about, okay, what's the next step? And that next step will definitely depend on the economy, and most importantly, on where COVID goes, which right now looks to be we're getting through it, but again, we're not through it yet.
President Daley, I hammered you with one side of the inflation debate, which is how and why it might be more permanent than you let on. But there's other forces that make it both temporary and have really depressed inflation over a long time. And that is a lot of it originating where you are right now, which is San Francisco and technology. Talk about the other side of the story there, this being the tech check show anyway. So about how technology will play a role, you believe, in keeping inflation down over time.
Well, it's not just technology, but that's absolutely a big factor. You know, one of the things happening globally is that the globe is, with the aging of the population, slower productivity growth, we just have slower growth more generally. Central banks everywhere are having trouble keeping inflation up to target. And technology has been one of the forces people point to, that we have a very globalized economy and goods and services can move freely. And technology's helped us know the price for things across the globe, not just across the country. These things are still there. Those things aren't going away. Technology-enabled production and service exchange, really something that we are continuing to see in the economy. So I remain bullish about our ability to grow and really focused on the fact that we are going forward going to be fighting inflation from below our target, most likely, not trying to pull it down to our target. So pandemic recovery aside, The forces on inflation, the global forces, are mostly to the downside.
President Daley, I have two more areas I want to ask you about. Do you look at things like the 10-year in the face of hot inflation numbers like we got today and see a 130, what am I looking at? Oh, call it 136 print on the 10-year and say, wait a second, either the Fed coming into this market is so distorting the price signal that I can't really get a read, or that these guys in the bond market are so chill with inflation that maybe I shouldn't worry about it either. Which message do you get from the 10-year?
So the thing you learn most when you look at financial markets is they move around for a variety of factors, not just one factor. So there are certainly reasons that the bond market is moving around, but I really go back and ask, what are the fundamentals? The fundamentals, as I see it, are these: that we have some prints on inflation that were expected. They're higher than we are usually seeing, and it's got people some worry. But most people, are, including CEOs I speak to, are really saying, wait a minute, there's a lot of reasons why these are likely to be. And again, long-run inflation expectations haven't moved that much. So that's not going to be something you see priced into markets generally. The other thing going on is that we're all experiencing the fact that COVID, while we have really good news on the vaccines and people getting vaccinated and getting this beaten back, this Delta variant has caused many of my contacts to say, okay, the global economy is likely to be a little slower in recovering than we had once thought. And we really want to make sure that that doesn't derail the U.S. expansion, or if not derail it, really temper it. And so I think we're really strong here. I'm very bullish, but risks are here and we have to be paying attention to those. And I think the bond market is paying attention to those.
Let me shift gears, President Daley, if you don't mind, to an area that you have talked a lot about, which is climate change and the role of the Federal Reserve. There have been some conservative lawmakers who have said, you know what, this is out of bounds or offsides for the Federal Reserve, that the Federal Reserve is getting too involved in social justice issues or issues that are out of its area of purview. How do you respond when you talk about climate change and the role of the Federal Reserve and whether it should be as involved as it has been?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that this is how democracies work, right? We do our work and then other people ask questions about it. Why is that your work? And then it's our duty to explain why it's our work. And here's, it's a really simple explanation. Climate and climate risk is affecting how businesses are doing their business. It makes it harder for wineries in California to get insurance. It makes it harder for agricultural producers to find insurance for their crops, which ultimately, if you can't insure, you cannot get a mortgage. This affects banks, of course, because now they have lent money to people and to businesses that are not as viable as they once were because of the weather. These extreme temperatures make it difficult for transportation networks to thrive, make it difficult for people to work outdoors for extended periods. All of this comes back to the simple goals that Congress gave us of full employment and price stability. So it's ultimately our duty to understand the risks that face us, even when we don't have the levers to pull to mitigate them.
President Daley, thank you for joining us today and talking about these important issues that are out there in your district and in the nation as a whole. Mary Daley, President of San Francisco Fed.
Thank you.
And our thanks to you, Steve. You covered a lot of ground there, from the Delta variant to the role of technology. Meanwhile, take a look at shares of Tesla. They led the NASDAQ 100 yesterday. Goldman reiterating its buy on the stock this morning, though it's down about 1%. We're live at the courthouse where Elon Musk is testifying. He's in the building you're about to see on your screen somewhere. You got it? We'll show you when we get back. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome back to Tech Check. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Deirdre Bosa, John Fort, and Julia Boorstin. Still ahead, the largest ever seed fund specifically for female founders. But first, let's get a news update with Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. And here's what's happening at this hour. Consumer prices surging in June. The 0.9% gain was well ahead of estimates and is the biggest monthly increase in 13 years. Prices for used cars and trucks shot up 10.5%. Year-over-year inflation is up 5.4%, also the most since 2008. Shares of Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase falling despite both companies posting quarterly results that were also well ahead of estimates. The stock moves raising concerns that investors are already pricing in big beats for the earnings season that's just getting underway this week. PepsiCo, one of the major companies rising on its earnings report this morning. The food and beverage giant getting help from higher drink sales in North America. PepsiCo also raising full-year EPS guidance. And Boeing is leading the declines in the Dow, the company cutting production of its 787 jets. That's after discovering a structural defect. Boeing now says that it will deliver fewer than half of the 787s that are in its inventory this year, instead of the vast majority of planes as previously expected. You're now up to date, Carl. I'll send it back to you.
All right, Rahel, thank you very much. Elon Musk returning to court today to defend Tesla's 2016 acquisition of SolarCity. Despite that court appearance, the shares closed up over 4% yesterday, but have turned lower this morning. Joining us this morning is Washington Post tech reporter Will Arimus, live outside the courthouse. He's been covering the trial. Will, welcome back. It's good to see you again. It's been a pretty steady diet of headlines. What's been the lead so far, other than he says he didn't set the terms of the deal and didn't want to be anybody's boss?
Yeah, and other than when he told the plaintiff's attorney that he thinks he's a bad human being, that made some headlines. Elon Musk always brings the entertainment value, even to this sort of staid environment of the Delaware Chancery Court. There's been a lot of back and forth between the plaintiff's attorney and Musk. They clearly don't like each other, although both men seem to relish a little bit of the verbal battles and the jousting. I think that what the attorney has done this morning is to really show that Musk was in close contact with both the Tesla team and the SolarCity team as this deal was being negotiated. Now, Musk said that he formally recused himself from the Tesla board's negotiations of the sale price when the deal happened. What the lawyer is trying to show that he was behind the scenes trying to make everything work, maybe trying to get a higher price for SolarCity and trying to hide just what bad shape SolarCity was in financially at the time that Tesla was acquiring it.
How would you characterize, at least at this stage, Musk's ability to detangle himself from that line of questioning? Obviously, depending on which way it went, it would have maybe broader implications for the scrutiny he would come under, given his strong control of Tesla, at least.
Yeah, he's a confident guy. He has not appeared shaken. He, if anything, appears exasperated. He delights in catching out the attorney in the occasional numerical mistake or mistake in his timeline or that sort of thing. But I think what we're really seeing here is a clash between this grand vision that Musk sketches out, where Tesla had to acquire SolarCity because it's about, you need this clean solar energy generation to power the clean electric cars, and the whole thing is about saving the planet, versus the version that the lawyer is laying out, where Musk orchestrated this bailout of his cousin's failing company to enrich himself and his cousin. And there's a lot of dirty details that kind of run contrary to the narrative that this was all about saving the world.
Will, hey, it's John Ford. Go a little conceptual for us, will you? How much of this is about Twitter Elon Musk on trial, in a sense? The Elon Musk who sometimes seems to believe that the regular rules don't apply to him, that he can kind of get around them with the way he wants to maneuver and with the results that he's going to deliver with his big ideas?
Yeah, he's always been, his whole career has been about, trying to reach the stars and then doing whatever it takes to make that happen, often making promises that he can't quite deliver on, pressuring everybody around him to deliver on those promises. The Elon Musk that we see in tweets, some of this trial suggests that it's not that different from the real Elon Musk and the way he behaves offline. I think one of the most interesting parts was when Musk said that a lot of his humorous tweets are actually strategic. They're about getting free advertising for Tesla. So when he changed his title to Techno King and went to the SEC and did an SEC filing, even got Tesla's lawyers involved to become Techno King of Tesla, he said, well, look, that's a lot cheaper than spending money on advertising and car commercials, and look how many free headlines I got out of it. So, to Elon, he's sort of the master, he's the wizard pulling all the strings, but if he's pulling the strings in a way that's about helping out his cousin or about lining his own pockets, then, the shareholders may have a problem with that.
That's fascinating about that title change to Techno King. Perhaps raises some questions about all of his Dogecoin tweets. But Will, I want to ask you sort of a broader question. If Musk loses this case, he will owe $2 billion, which is not a lot for him, given that his wealth is above $150 billion. Are there any implications if he loses this case for Tesla or for the clean energy industry at large?
That's a good question. Tesla's stock price suggests that the shareholders who are not part of this lawsuit seem to be pretty bullish on its future still. I think this is really more of a referendum on Musk and his leadership. It's there's always this tension in the way Musk runs his companies as to whether he is gonna pull the rabbit out of the hat and deliver the magic and please the crowds and it will all be a happy ending, or whether at some point it's all going to come apart, and his volatile nature and his bending of the rules and of timelines will come back and haunt him and haunt the company and the shareholders. I think that's, those are really the stakes here, is whether Musk can be trusted as a steward of this company, not to mention SpaceX, going forward. I mean, it's a huge company now, or whether, he whether he is the fast-talking huckster that a lot of his critics portray him to be. I think it's personal in a way for Musk. I think that's why he's here defending himself. You know, the rest of the Tesla board settled this out of court for $60 million. But here's Elon making his case, I think he's a guy who doesn't like to lose.
Yeah, certainly. A courtroom has a way of bringing out the human drama and some sharper relief, Will. And we're all benefiting from your coverage for sure. I appreciate it. Thanks very much, Will Arimus of The Washington Post.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Shares of Electronic Arts leading the S&P this morning, upgraded to outperform at BMO. Price target goes to $168, up nearly 3% today. They say EA shares are the least expensive among the gaming sector. Stay with us. More Tech Check next.
Female Founders Fund includes some heavy hitters as backers. Julia Boorstin has more on the latest round. Julia.
Well, John, Female Founders Fund just closed its third fund at $57 million. That's the biggest ever seed fund focused just on female entrepreneurs. This fund was oversubscribed with investors including Goldman Sachs, Cambridge Associates, Melinda Gates, Pivotal Ventures, as well as YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki and 23andMe CEO Ann Wojcicki. These investors are drawn to the success of the first two funds. Its investments include Rent the Runway, Eloquii, which sold to Walmart in 2019, Billy, which sold to Procter & Gamble, wedding registry company Zola and Disruptor 50 company Tala, and the focus on female entrepreneurs as well.
I think some of the newer themes post-COVID, so one would be looking at workplace efficiency tools, you know, in this somewhat post-COVID hybrid world where, you know, you're looking at a combination of work from home as well as return to office. What are different platforms and tools that can make that experience more seamless?
Now, founding partner Anu Dugal is focused on those categories she sees as poised to grow. In addition to workplace efficiency, she's also looking at healthcare, education, online community, and climate change, of course, as well as hybrid work. And now she's also looking at some of the ways that female investors might be an untapped opportunity.
We believe that founders that are successful are authentically building oftentimes products or solutions that speak to their lived experiences. And so when we look at Fund 3, you know, the investments we've made so far are actually 70% BIPOC. And when you look at the types of businesses that these founders are building, it's a reflection of both their professional experience, but also their personal experience.
And with female founders drawing less than 3% of all venture capital dollars in the U.S., Dugal's fund is looking for those untapped opportunities. Deirdre, over to you.
Great piece, Julia. Thanks for that. After the break, President Biden beefs up his cybersecurity team, plus getting a gut check on First Solar, downgraded from buy to neutral at Citi this morning after the stock jumped 20% in the last 3 months. Sticking with the $100 price target, shares currently at 93 and change. More Tech Check after the break.
Worldwide PC shipments had been shrinking for years. Then the pandemic hit, and the industry saw its first big growth in a decade as we needed new devices to do work and school from home. Now it's 2021, and global PC shipments are still growing, up 4% year over year, according to new data from Gartner. Of course, that's a far cry from the double-digit growth in 2020. Lenovo had 24% of PC shipments worldwide in Q2. HP and Dell trailed with 20 and 17%. But which company saw the most growth? Well, Apple, by a mile. Apple shipped nearly 20% more units than it did in Q2 of last year. Chromebooks not included in those numbers, but overall the total market for PCs and Chromebooks grew 10% year over year. The U.S., though, a different story. After three consecutive quarters of double-digit growth, the market shrank here by 3.7%, largely because the chip shortage made it hard for businesses to find laptops. In the U.S., HP, Dell, and Apple lead in terms of units shipped, with Lenovo and Microsoft rounding out the top five. Carl, it's going to be an important metric to track how the Windows 11 launch does and how Apple's doing with building in its own chips in Macs.
Yeah, pretty interesting debate when these numbers came out from IDC this week, guys, because as we know from the likes of Katie Huberty, there was a longstanding thesis that we were in some kind of new normal for PC growth as the office environment was changing. But still a big debate raging about what exactly PCs are going to do, at least from a growth standpoint from here on out.
Right. And it's not like everyone's going back to work, at least right away. This new hybrid work model means that many companies are still upgrading or could still be upgrading their equipment. And that could mean more PC sales. So I guess, Carl, that's the big question is, do these sales continue post-pandemic? And you've got things like the chip shortage playing a part as well. But wow, those numbers from Apple.
Oh, yeah. Q1 numbers, absolutely insane. By the way, check out shares of Okta this morning. Goldman does initiate with a buy. Price target 312 would be 27% upside from the current levels. Stocks rising over 1,000% since debuting in 2017, but just negative for the year to date. By the way, don't miss the biggest calls on the street. You can subscribe to CNBC Pro, cnbc.com/pro. And we're back after this.
The Biden administration filling out their cybersecurity team. Eamon Javers has that for us. And Eamon, coming at a pretty crucial time.
Yeah, Deirdre, file this one under better late than never, right? President Biden is getting the cybersecurity team that he wanted in place. The Senate yesterday confirmed Jen Easterly as the director of DHS's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. She will be just the second Senate-confirmed director to lead the agency since it was created back in 2018. And the Senate also confirmed Chris Inglis to be Biden's national cyber director, giving the White House a lead official at a time of these major ransomware impacts on corporate America. Now, the two officials who are seen here testifying together earlier this year are both veterans of the National Security Agency. Easterly has also worked at the White House on cybersecurity and terrorism issues. Inglis is an Air Force veteran who will lead a brand new office unit called the Office of National Cyber Director out of the White House. Now, I had lunch yesterday with Admiral Mike Rogers, the former head of the National Security Agency. He was extremely bullish on both of these officials. One challenge, though, for them, particularly for this new White House office, will be staffing up the unit and developing clear lines of authority over which agency is responsible for which pieces of this vast cybersecurity challenge, guys. And one thing for you on a separate story. We talked in the last hour about the hacker group R-Evil going offline. All their websites that are publicly facing now are dark. There's some question as to who's responsible for that. Is that the Russians? Is that the United States taking action against R-Evil? I emailed the National Security Council, a National Security Council official, just moments ago in response to my question about whether this is U.S. action, emailed me back and said, no comment. Guys, back over to you.
All right. Eamon, thanks. I was going to be surprised if you got a detailed explanation there, but I know you'll continue to work at it. Eamon, thanks.
Nothing yet in detail from the White House. Yeah.
Now, our next guest just raised $150 million in a Series F round, taking the company from Unicorn, which it was already, to a $4 billion valuation in just 10 months. Joining us now is the co-founder and CEO of cybersecurity firm Arctic Wolf, Brian Naismith. Brian, good to have you. So this model that you've got is interesting, sort of a platform that allows experts from Arctic Wolf to really get hands-on and help manage a customer's existing security system. Why is this a particularly potent pitch at this time?
Well, two reasons. The threat environment is as bad as I've ever seen it. So it's, you know, people are frightened, they're concerned. We read on the news. You guys talk about it all the time. So there's a real big problem there. The other aspect is there's a talent shortage. People can't find the people to do this work. So combined with the problem, we're able to deliver a solution that helps them address some of that technical deficiency as well as the talent needs that they have.
Now, Brian, given the particular challenges we're seeing right now, ransomware is top of mind. How does a model like Arctic Wolf's come to bear? Are you able to get in with experts and sort of audit more quickly the weaknesses in an organization and act based on that without bringing in new software or new equipment? Or what's the model that's relevant to what we see right now?
We work pretty much with whatever the customer has in place. So they're trying to address their risk. They're trying to understand what's taking place in that environment. And we'll work no matter what they've got going in that environment. What we offer to the customer is an enterprise class, world-class security operations capability. And so we leverage our TAC platform and we enable any organization of any size basically to operate as if they're a world-class organization.
Brian, talk about the decision to raise money in the private markets, $150 million in a Series F funding versus the idea of going public when I'm sure you guys could use the publicity and the marketing. Why did you decide to go this route?
Well, one, because we could. I think, you know, raising money, we needed a war chest. We're very acquisitive in what we're doing. We see opportunities to build on the tech stack that we've already started and add new capabilities for our customers, and we thought we could exploit that. I would say, more importantly, we don't have a challenge getting to people seeing the opportunity that we're delivering to them. So that there's so much fear in the marketplace. People are looking for answers about how can they manage this cyber risk? How can they not be the next person on the front page of the news? And so, you know, we don't have a challenge getting to the market. So the publicity dynamic is not needed. We're on the road to going public. So it's definitely on the horizon here and coming. I've run a public company previously at Blue Coat. So we have an understanding of what it takes to be there. And we're well on that path. But we have plenty of opportunity we're chasing now.
All right. Important to note. So explain, please, how this is more than traditional outsourcing, how technology in your platform comes to bear to allow the experts that you have at Arctic Wolf, I suppose, to be more efficient and serve more customers at once. What's the technology involved that sort of expands the effectiveness of this outsourcing and services model?
Yeah, traditionally what a customer would do is they would take something called a SIEM. They would collect the log data. It cost them a lot to do that. We've built a unique cloud-based native architecture that allows us to bring data into our environment and do it somewhat independent of the amount of data that we need to collect. So it's innovative, allowing us to get a high gross margin, kind of high 70s gross margin, but also a toolkit. It's not simply collecting the data, but it's the toolkit along with the people that is necessary to do this service. All that wrapped together. It's that what we call our concierge model. We create a very intimate model. So each customer is unique. Their challenges are unique. Their threat landscape is unique. And it changes all the time. So it's very hard for an organization of any size to keep up with the, I don't know, is it the Russians attacking now? Is it some other nation state? Is this sort of hacktivist or a ransomware event? We roll and move with that and make that investment so the customer doesn't have to worry about it. But it's that cloud native platform combined with our service delivery model that we call concierge that creates that customized unique experience for each customer. They don't need all this other stuff to make it work. We provide a whole outcome-based capability that gets them what they're looking for.
Yeah, that is the most interesting part. Brian, appreciate it.
Thank you.
CEO of Arctic Wolf. Carl?
If you missed part of the show, you can follow our podcast, listen anytime, anywhere, available wherever you download podcasts. S&P session high here, just about 9 points from 4,400.
Before we go, check out Chinese internet stocks. They have obviously had a tough run, but they're turning around today, including Didi, Alibaba, and Baidu. They are all in the green, despite that recent regulatory crackdown, though well in the red for the year. Early Didi and Ant Group investor Temasek Holdings, the large Singapore fund, said earlier this morning that they remain optimistic about their Chinese investments, and they're still looking for growth opportunities in the country.
No worries, Dee. Meantime, Emmy noms trickling out ahead of the awards show in September. A number of shows were pushed off last year because of the pandemic, but there's still a strong slate of shows. Netflix's The Crown, Bridgerton, The Queen's Gambit, Disney's The Mandalorian, Ted Lasso from Apple are among the early favorites. By platform, HBO has 130 noms, Netflix one behind at 129, Disney Plus 71 nominations, and quickly joining those front runners, NBC, then Apple, CBS, Hulu, ABC, and Amazon's last with only 18 nominations. The only streamer to ever win Best Drama is Hulu 4 years ago for Handmaid's Tale.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern.